This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Greg Shanley. It seems everyone is looking at the first decade of our 21st century and finding that in many categories, things got worse, even in such areas as food and restaurants. Bloggers especially are taking shots at certain fads that were here for a while and gone the next year, and some trends that are still with us, such as the $40 entree and the community table. This hour will narrow our food focus to Iowa and try to find out what changed in our dining out and dining in experiences. We know that we have more restaurants to choose from and a greater variety of ethnic choices and some new terms, foodies, locavores, and the chef celebrity. To explore the decade in Iowa food, we'll hear from the managers of two restaurants and the editor of Edible Iowa River Valley. Talk of Iowa follows Iowa Public Radio and NPR News. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Greg Shanley. We want to look at some of the trends here in the past 10 years in Iowa, how food has changed since 2000. Kurt and Kim Fries, co-editors, managing editor, publisher, the great magazine Edible Iowa River Valley. Kim, what have you seen in the last 10 years?
In the last 10 years, and particularly since the magazine's only been around for 3 years, but I've been able to see it from a vantage point of running a restaurant as a buyer and a little bit as a producer, as a cook, and what people are looking for when they come into the restaurant. So I have that vantage point. Seeing what people are looking for in food, they're looking for fresher, they're looking for local. They're starting to realize that it's an important part of our community to be a conscious consumer and making conscious choices about what they're eating.
I think it's fascinating that when I started in this business 30 years ago, the restaurants were always judged by how distant and exotic their ingredients were. And today it's quite the opposite. The closer it is to the kitchen door, chances are the higher you could rate the restaurant. The better restaurants are buying stuff as locally as possible and not looking to, you know, New Zealand or China or Africa or wherever else they're going to go for their ingredients. They're trying to get them from right nearby. And the reason for that is very simple. It's fresher and therefore tastes better. Plus, there's something special about knowing the farmer, you know, shaking the hand that raises the food.
Yeah. What about those restaurant owners that are not close to any food? Not talking about Iowa. I'm thinking of places like New Mexico, desert locations. What do they do about being fresh and local? If we can just move away from Iowa for a minute, really.
Some of the best restaurants in the world, in Santa Fe, in Tucson, Arizona, Nogales. There's still food there. It's very different. Just as we have challenges up here with a long winter, they have challenges down there with no water. But there's still plenty of food.
And Matt Steigerwald, owner of the Lincoln Cafe in Mount Vernon, what have you seen?
I feel the same way. It is a case where the people that come to our restaurant want to know where the food's from more and more. When we first moved to Iowa in 2000 from the East Coast, we came from an environment where there was a lot of interaction with the restaurants and the diners already, and we had a lot of local farmers there that we dealt with. Moving out to here, there was less of it, but now after this, you know, last 9 years or so that we've had the restaurant open, that's really grown. I mean, there's a lot more of it in Iowa now than there was when I first moved here. I used to have maybe one local farmer that I could purchase organic local stuff from. Every year now, there are a couple more that come to my door and ask me what I'm looking for, and they're doing local and organic, and they're from within 5 miles, from within a mile, some of them. And some of them are just gardeners. You know, they have stuff in their backyard. And they're excited about it, and then they eat it, and they get excited that we're making their food, and they bring their friends in, and, you know, it's really become a buzz. You know, the local thing has really become a buzz.
So where did you come from then originally?
Raleigh.
Yeah. Wonderful town.
Yeah, it was. I lived in Raleigh when I was young, and then went to school at UNC Chapel Hill, and worked in restaurants there, and I moved to Richmond, Virginia, and worked there for a while. And we moved out here in 2000, in the fall of 2000.
And why did you choose Iowa then?
Because my wife got a job at Cornell College teaching English.
Okay. And, that worked out, didn't it?
It worked out, and that's why we moved out here. And then the restaurant was empty. You know, there was no one in the place. It had been a restaurant, but it was very inexpensive, and I just decided to buy it and do my own thing. After working for about 6 weeks for Kurt, of course.
Yeah, taught him everything he knows.
Right, exactly.
Well, it sounds like you are all happy with the trends.
Yeah, it's just a matter of getting people to think about what they're eating and what's better for them, and the hidden cost of cheap food, too, is something important to think about.
Yeah, to mitigate the deleterious side effects of all that fast processed food, edible food-like substances.
But even I mean, to their credit, we must say that McDonald's has done. They're trying to do some things a little bit
when they do things well, they should certainly be patted on the back for it and said thanks. That's great. Now here's something else that you can do. Not just McDonald's, but anybody else, be it Walmart or Applebee's or whoever it happens to be over on that side. But there are so many of them doing so many things that are so detrimental to our health and to the well-being of the planet and our children's well-being, that there's just a great deal more work that needs to be done, and the statistics are there to prove it. So.
Yeah, I really feel like on that point, I do think there's been growth in the past decade in Iowa specifically, but you have to admit that for every restaurant that opens up like ours, where people are trying to do something good for the people and the planet and the food, there's also another Applebee's that opens up down the road, and there's also another whatever, you know, Chili's that opens up down the road. And it's a never-ending battle. I mean, it's not like it's all roses out there. There's a lot of bad stuff going on that we need to work harder, and I don't know that we're ever going to get rid of those things. I think it'd be great if we could, but I think they're still sort of winning the battle for the American
Function of the golden rule. You know, he who has the gold makes the rules.
Right. Yeah.
You ever notice the food section in Consumer Reports will rate the restaurant chains? And I noticed in the last issue there's, 20 restaurant chains. We might have two of those here in Iowa. There's a lot of chains that we don't have, mm-hmm. for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And coming from a bigger city, you probably noticed that.
Well, I would bet that's based more on just, the market. I mean, there's not a population here like there would be, in Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill. And so I think that once it's saturated by a certain number of chains, they just might not have a reason to come in.
Sure. Conversely, I think that Iowa City and the surrounding area, reaching up as far as Mount Vernon and maybe down as far south as, Washington or Fairfield, we have far more restaurants here per capita, I think, than just about any place. I mean, good restaurants. Considering how small our population is here, we have a huge number of really good restaurants.
But you can say that about the rest of the state, Des Moines, Ames, Marshalltown, some of the other cities in the state, right, that you've noticed? Yeah. Des Moines especially is amazing.
Yep, really taken
amazing
off.
Improvements in the last 10 years and choice and whatnot.
I mean, I think one of the biggest things that hit me when I moved here and never having been here before or to the Midwest was when I moved here, my first thought was, this is not a food culture. These people don't care about food for the most part. Of course, I'm not saying everybody, but there's not this sort of food culture where you're thinking about what we're going to have for dinner tonight. You know, I mean, at home and New Orleans, we visit a lot, and all day you're talking about what you're going to make for dinner, what you have for lunch, what you're going to make, what do you want to make. And there's something really fun about that for me. And I've definitely seen that grow. I mean, that is something that I think in people's homes, there's more of an emphasis on making good food. I think you have to draw a line between the restaurants that are bringing people in and what people are making at home. And I think I think the home thing is great. You know, we have more markets. We have New Pioneer and there's things like that. And the more of those, the better.
And isn't it fascinating that a so-called agricultural state
is not
thinking about food? What's
no, that's because we don't grow food. We grow feed.
That's right.
Fuel.
That's right. That's right.
Well, the fact is you don't have to drive to Chicago anymore to find a decent restaurant if you live in Iowa. Any
that's
place
true.
In Iowa.
That's true. For sure.
Yeah. Matt, let's talk about your restaurant.
Okay.
Your restaurant is called a Lincoln Cafés.
Yeah.
What is the
we have a, and we have the wine bar as well. That's like three
and
doors
the wine
down.
Bar,
Lincoln Wine Bar,
which
yeah.
is what a few doors down the
yeah,
block.
Yeah, three doors down the block
in downtown Mount Vernon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is your philosophy?
You know, I get asked that a lot, and I used to say, you know, I like to eat foods. You know, I started looking at my menus and what I like to cook, and I would always be making foods from warm parts of the world. Like I like Southeast Asian, I like South American, Mediterranean, American South. But I think that, you know, the more that I get asked about what kind of food we do or what we like to do, it's more about what we like to eat. You know, I mean, at the restaurant, I make the food I like to eat. Strong, bold flavors, making attempts at some matter of authenticity. Also with a kind of sense that it's just food and we're still kind of like playing and it's fun. That mixed with making attempts to get as much as I can local and organic. It's important to have local organic, but it's also important that it tastes good. I have to say that if I have someone making locally beef or something and I just don't think it tastes great,
yeah.
I'm not likely to buy it based on the fact that when I make it and I sell it, it's not going to make the customer as happy as if I were to get something from 500 miles away. Not great, but I still am in the business of making them happy first, I think. You know what I'm saying?
Well, having yeah. eaten in your restaurant, but what you like to eat apparently is what a lot of other people like to eat. Is your
well,
place
I hope
is
so. Always, I hope so, right?
The place is always packed.
Yeah.
People lined up.
Yeah.
And Kurt
Thank
and Kim, owners of a similar restaurant in Iowa City called Devotee. And I'm sure you would agree with Matt on a lot of what he said on your philosophy.
Sure, yeah. I think the only thing that I might add to it is a firm belief that if it wasn't food 100 years ago, it's not food now.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that there are all sorts of things that are being passed off as food these days that simply aren't food. They're what Michael Pollan called edible food-like substances. They're fake food.
And a good way to recognize that, I think, is to avoid foods that need a label, for example.
So they need to list the ingredients.
Well, you're talking
– It's more than five ingredients on the label. You don't want to
right.
eat that
right,
stuff.
No.
You're talking
you
more about grocery
it.
Stores and restaurants.
Sure, but that stuff is what gets sold in a majority of the restaurants as well. And and there's a huge difference in the ratio of nutrients to calories.
Because the consumers, I don't think, normally figure that restaurants are going to be buying processed food.
Okay. I don't think
really
the restaurants
surprising.
That we like do.
No.
You know, I mean, you know, that's not something that we do. It's not something they do. It's not something that anybody who we respect does.
Hold on. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back our conversation about the decade in food in Iowa as Talk of Iowa continues in a minute here on Iowa Public Radio. Back to Talk of Iowa, food in the state. And a lot of people have talked about trends in food. I've been seeing all these TV lists of what's been happening in the decade, but it seems like food is just as important as politics. I don't know. Kurt Fries, Kim Fries, Matt Steigerwald, the Kurt and Kim publisher of the magazine Edible Iowa River Valley, Matt Steigerwald, owner of a wonderful cafe in Mount Vernon in eastern Iowa called the Lincoln Cafe. How long has Edible Iowa River Valley been going now? A couple of years or more?
About 3.5 years now. Issue 15 will come out March 1st.
And when you say Edible Iowa River Valley, so you're focusing this on eastern Iowa?
Well, primarily. We do cover the whole state, but it is primarily from the Des Moines-Ames metro eastward. We've done a few stories from out west, but we do primarily cover this. And the name came from, well, looking at this half of the state where the larger proportion of the population is. And I was looking at a map one day and seeing how it was sort of geographically arranged. And there are these three main rivers that run right through it, the Cedar, the Iowa, and the Des Moines. And the Iowa is smack in the middle of those. So I figured, you know, I wanted a name that sort of reflected the land a little bit more. And that's why we chose Iowa River Valley.
Well, when you let's just for a moment go outside of our fine state of Iowa. When you've been traveling, you three, the last few years, what have you seen for food trends elsewhere? Just curious.
I think we've seen, especially on the coasts, the local sustainable movement is even more much more powerful than it is here, as things often do, as things trickle from the coast to the Midwest. And we see
we only
that.
Let the good stuff through.
That's right. And so we're seeing quite a bit of that. People are thinking about that more often. You know, you see more whole foods, for example, and more people thinking about, you know, buying organics and buying locally when possible. Those market trends.
Okay, what about restaurants especially? What about the style of restaurants?
I think there's been a real move towards making, and this works for my restaurant, so I'm happy about it, making high-end food in a very relaxed environment. In Chicago.
Now, when you say high-end, you mean expensive?
Not necessarily expensive, but
high quality.
High quality, well-crafted food. Hey, you know, in a place where it doesn't necessarily have white tablecloths and silver. I think there's a real strong move in that direction. I think the other thing that is really big is the, you know, the whole hog thing, you know, the animals, like getting in whole animals and breaking them down and making, curing them for hams and sausages, things like that, is really become a thing. There are butchers in New York that are now like celebrity chefs are, you know, in that same way. And there's you know, it's really a way to use all the parts of the pig and all the parts of, you know, the cow, whatever animal you're doing. And that's become something that it's hard to go into a restaurant, a nice restaurant in Chicago, and there's not a menu that has their house-made salumi, their house-made charcuterie, which I think is really great and fun.
Right, that sustainable meat consumption. I mean, has always been, I think, and will always be an argument between us omnivores and the vegetarians and vegans of the world, and that's all well and good. But it is important to be, if you are going to be a meat eater like I am, to be sourcing your meat from reliable, reputable places, places where the animals are not mistreated, where they're not pumped full of all sorts of chemicals.
Well, let's talk about vegetarianism and veganism. Have you guys seen any statistics as far as are there more vegetarians / vegans around today than there were 10 years ago?
I haven't seen any statistics, but
I have no idea.
There are, but I really don't know.
Oh, you have a gut feeling?
Yeah.
There are
maybe,
more?
Maybe it's because I live in a college town and it feels like it.
Yeah. You know, in the restaurants, a small menu we have, and we do get people in asking for special vegan or vegetarian things, I'd say more often now than we did 5 years ago, but it might just be because we're a little more popular than we were 5 years ago probably too, and there's more people coming in. That's possible.
And do you have a more creative response in your restaurant than just having a Boca Burger offer to
yes,
you?
Yes, definitely. I think it's really important. And some people –
nothing wrong with Boca Burgers.
Right, exactly. No, I mean I certainly don't eat as much meat as I used to, and I like to know where it comes from. The word locavore, you know, applies to a lot of people. I know a lot of people who won't eat meat unless they know exactly where it comes from. So they generally, especially when dining out, will eat a vegetarian diet. It's been very beneficial for us to have a well-informed front of house staff knowing what's in all of the dishes that we serve, vegetarian or not. And it's very important to our customers.
About 60% of our menu is vegetarian, and that's not necessarily by design. That's just how it happened to work out. And about a third of that 60% is actually vegan. It's because that's what the dish is. So that, you know, it's not because we set out to make a vegan dish.
Yeah. So to answer my question, it seems like maybe there's not more vegetarian restaurants per se, but there's better offerings within restaurants like your restaurants for people who want that option and maybe some more creative and delectable choices.
I think that as the United States becomes more, you know, of a multicultural place, the food desires of those people must also become more multicultural. And that said, there's many, many cultures around the world that focus a lot more on non-meat food than the United States does.
Cultures like, give me an example.
Like, you know, like the Middle East. There's a lot of places, like you go there to eat, places to eat in Syria and Turkey, where you're not necessarily going to get a big steak with a little garnish. You're going to get beans and lentils and cheese and maybe there's a little lamb. You know what I mean?
It's Southeast Asia where meat is more the condiment than it is the center of the plate.
It's a flavoring.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. What about my favorite food country, Mexico?
There's a lot of meat in Mexico.
There's a lot of meat.
But there's a wonderful new Mexican restaurant here in Iowa City, El Bandidos. It has
been
vegetarian
options.
It's right around the corner from my restaurant, and I still haven't been there yet.
They have vegetarian options. I haven't tried them.
Yeah, we can go there tonight.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe it's just rice and beans, but I have a feeling there's probably more to it.
We'll let you know.
Kurt, you have this look on your face like you want to say something disturbing.
Well, I've been because I do a lot of writing about food and studying about it. I end up seeing an awful lot of the statistics that are out there that reflect what has happened to our food system in the last 50, 60, 70 years. And there is a direct correlation between our newfound, and by new I mean 50, 60 years, newfound preference for quick and convenient, and the problems that we have in our health system. In 1949, we spent 22% of our income on food. And today we spend 9%.
Wow.
In that same time period in 1949, we spent 4% of our income on our health care. We now spend 16%, more than any other country, on our health care. There's a direct correlation there. In 1959, 4% of our children were overweight. Today, 19%.
There's some other reasons probably that have to enter into the obesity thing, like high fructose corn syrup, which shows
and
up.
There are those I know very well in this state who will disagree with me about the detrimental effects of high fructose corn syrup. But you can draw a very simple graph noting the use of high fructose corn syrup from when it started in the 70s until now, and then draw a graph on the increase in childhood diabetes, type 2 diabetes in this country, and you could lay those two over each other on an overhead projector and they would match up perfectly. There is a distinct correlation, and it's not just high fructose corn syrup itself, it's the ubiquitousness of it, it's the prevalence of it, it's everywhere. It's in something like 90% of the foods in your grocery store right now.
I noticed that when I was looking at How do you keep it out of your food in your restaurants, your Iowa restaurants?
Well, we buy food, for one thing.
Right.
Like Kurt said, if it wasn't food 100 years ago, it's not food now. If it needs a label to tell you what's all inside that package, it's probably not food. So, you know, sticking with whole food, as little processing as possible for home use and for our restaurant. And I know Matt's it's very important to him, too, to use whole, real foods, whole apples, whole wheat.
Yeah, we're not buying the stuff that, you know, the stuff that's already cut up at the at the store. So I think that's where the high fructose corn syrup gets into it, when it's handed to someone before it's handed to the diner or the restaurant.
Well, hold that thought. We want to take a break for just a few minutes, talk of Iowa. We'll continue after we check the environment report and local weather. Kurt Fries, Kim Fries, Matt Steigerwald, as we look at the food decade in Iowa, mostly in Iowa, and some other areas as well. Stay with us on Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Rees for Greg Shanley. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Rees, sitting in today for Greg Shanley. We're discussing the food decade in Iowa with Matt Steigerwald, who owns a fine restaurant in Mount Vernon in eastern Iowa called the Lincoln Cafe. Kurt Fries and Kim Fries, who run their own restaurant in Iowa City, Devotee, another very fine restaurant, and also editors and publishers of a fairly new magazine, lovely, well-illustrated magazine called Edible Iowa River Valley. And let me ask you, Matt, since you are from the East Coast, what's the difference? And we talked earlier about Iowans versus the rest of the world, but I'm not thinking of so much as food. What do Iowans want in a restaurant environment? What sort of an experience do they want?
Well, I think when I first moved here, I would have thought Iowans want as much food on their plate for as little money as they can get away with.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Huge pile of mashed potatoes and a huge, you know, well-done pork chop. But the more that we've been doing this, the more that you know that there is a population out there that's really excited to find you and to see that you're doing something other than that. You know, I mean, they want – I think it's getting to the point where they want what we want. It's just a matter of keeping the word, you know, always working on spreading the word. And the more people come into Devotee or the cafe for the first time and they get something – I mean, you know, it happens every week. Someone will come in, never been to a restaurant like that, like this, whatever that means, and they eat some and they go, wow, this is really great. It's not like anything I've had before, and they're really excited about it. And they come back, and then that's how you build a customer base, and then they tell their friends, and they tell their friends.
I have to admit I have no understanding of people who aren't willing to taste food and to try new things. I mean, the worst thing that could possibly happen is that you'll have a flavor in your mouth that you kind of don't like, and it'll be there for 20, 30 seconds so you finish drinking that glass of water.
Right.
That's the worst thing that could happen. The best thing that could happen is you could discover this whole new world of food and these taste sensations and experiences you've never known before. That's the high end. So I think it's easily worth the risk. Everybody should, you know, really branch out and try new things.
What about sushi in Iowa? We have sushi places now. I don't think we had sushi places 10 years ago.
Maybe 15. I mean, there has been that one on Gilbert Street.
Aoshi's been there for quite a while.
Yeah.
They do a nice job.
But certainly been a big increase
continue?
In them of lately.
Is that still going to be a hot restaurant trend, do you think?
I suspect so, yeah.
I think the sushi is going to continue. I've noticed a downward trend, however, in raw fish in sushi, just because, well, the sustainability of fish has gone down quite a bit. So
bluefin tuna, for example, overfished.
Sure. Yeah, but even ones that you know and like and eat every day are going away quickly.
They're going away quickly.
Yeah, can I do my little rant about sea bass for just
do
a
it.
Second
yeah.
here?
Chilean sea bass.
Okay, yeah. Now listen. This,
which was the, there's used a, to be the Patagonian.
Patagonian toothfish is what this thing is really right. called, but somebody realized that nobody was going to buy anything called a Patagonian toothfish, delicious as it happened to be. So some marketing people got together and decided to call it Chilean sea bass. And right then it went through the roof. Everybody loves it. It's one of my favorite fish to eat too. But if you ever want to eat Chilean sea bass again, don't eat it now because the stocks are being decimated. These are fish that cannot even reproduce until they turn 8 years old, and all these fish are being pulled out of the water at 1 and 2 years old.
And I think everything that's being pulled out right now is pirated, isn't it?
Nearly all. There are some that have some very limited legal licenses that are very tightly controlled, but very little of that ever gets here.
A lot of the fish situation is really bad in a micro environment. I mean, just last week from the Virginia border down to the South Carolina border, they said no red snapper.
Snapper, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that's happened. I mean, there are these warnings now every week now where they're not, you know, where you're not allowed to catch this fish anymore because the populations are just really going away quick. I think that one thing I like about the past 10 years in food is FedEx and the fact that I can get amazing fish flown to me overnight, and I often do. But the downfall of that is more fresh fish is going into the middle of the country and it's hurting the populations.
So fish can fly. I didn't realize.
Yeah, they do. They do.
Well, what fish can we eat without endangering some population?
My current favorite is Alaskan black cod, otherwise called sablefish. Very sustainable sources of that right now. Most of, but not quite all, of your shellfish. Oysters are an exception. Oysters are in trouble in a lot of different places. Mussels, especially from Prince Edward Island, are a great thing to eat.
Sardines.
Sardines and anchovies, those little ones.
A lot of sardines. We do that sometimes. You know, we get in the fresh ones and we will marinate them.
Oh, yeah.
Delicious.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And anchovies get a bad rap because, you know, people used to get really bad ones on pizza for a long time and decided that they hated anchovies. But if you try the good ones, the well-made ones, they're tasty.
They're nice. But we also, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, you can't say all flounder, don't eat it. I mean, there are definitely smaller and larger different, I guess what's called breeding grounds, where they will let you fish in these areas for these 2 weeks. And I have to just, you know, hope that the people who I have these conversations with, who are like from the what's the fisheries management place in Charleston, South Carolina? You know the name of that place?
No, I can't remember what they're called.
You know, they have the best interest in mind of these fish. And then if they say it's okay to fish these fish right now, then I'm okay with it too.
And there's EcoFish out of Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's the Monterey Bay Aquarium in California has a wonderful website with easy references for everybody to check out any kind of fish.
And there's an app you can get on your phone.
Yeah, get an iPhone app.
And just look in the restaurant, which fish should I not order?
I was looking at some 19th century newspapers that I've collected, mostly Eastern Iowa newspapers, 1860 through 1890. And almost every restaurant, the main thing they advertised was oysters. I was absolutely amazed at how many oysters people ate back then. And I don't think I've seen oysters on a menu.
Are they river oysters?
You know why it is? No, they're Gulf oysters.
Okay.
And we sent barges back then. We sent barges. The Mississippi River traffic was much, much heavier than it is now. And we sent barges down to the port of New Orleans to ship to all over the world. Full of grain or full of iron ore from up in Minnesota and such. And those barges had to come back and they had to be full of something. Otherwise, it's a wasted trip. So a lot of times they were carrying oysters with them.
Mm-hmm.
And
were they,
Kim's grandfather used to make oyster stew for Christmas every year, the man who would never set foot in the kitchen otherwise. Christmas time, he made oyster
and
stew.
And I'd always wondered, too, why you know, a Scottish family in Davenport, Iowa would have oysters. Where that tradition came from was quite odd, but that's why, because they came up the river.
My grandfather loved them. He used to eat them raw, which I could just kind of gross me out.
I eat them raw all the time.
Oh, me too.
You do?
Absolutely.
I do too. I tend to prefer to do it when I'm a little bit closer to the coast and can trust the source, but yeah. there's a wide variety of them that I think are just fantastic. The Olympia oysters in Washington, the Chincoteague off the coast of Virginia, one of my all-time favorites.
The Kumamoto's are my
Kim
favorite.
Kim loves the little Kumamoto.
Yeah, Michelle likes those.
I mean, do you put something on them like Worcestershire sauce or something?
You can.
For
There's
some
a number
flavor.
Of traditional things. Sometimes Tabasco, lemon juice, yeah. Malt vinegar,
horseradish.
Horseradish. Oh, yeah. But straight
or
up.
Mignonette, like a little mignonette, like yep. a little
and
shallot.
Kim's favorite dessert in the whole wide world is oysters and champagne.
Sure.
Dessert.
Right. Yeah. Or breakfast.
Sure, or breakfast or lunch or dinner or midday snack. Or
I want to, I've been looking, believe it or not, to get ready for this interview at some food blogs, and this miscellaneous blogs, and it's interesting because everybody has a top 10 list, it seems like, on these blogs of trends that they hate in restaurants and in general food preparation, but mostly restaurants in the past 10 years. I'm going to run down a few of these and see if you guys have any.
I've got a couple. I don't know if I've got 10.
You have
I've
a,
got
couple
a couple
of yourself. Okay, this is – I won't mention these bloggers' names because nobody's going to know who they are. Mashed potatoes served in a martini glass. They dish you up a glob of potatoes, then you pick the toppings. It's bumpkin in person. This, you heard of that? I don't remember.
Yeah, there was about a month there when I think I saw it on a couple of menus in probably the late 90s somewhere. I never fell victim to it, though.
The only thing that goes in a martini glass, in my opinion, is gin.
Yeah, and just if I could just get off on a rant there for a second, is the probably my biggest pet peeve in the last 10 years is martinis that aren't martinis.
You mean flavored martinis.
All these different flavors and colors, and I'm sure they might be wonderful cocktails.
That's great, but
putting them in a martini glass does not make them a martini. You couldn't make them in a beer glass and then call them a beer. It's a martini is made of gin and vermouth. I'll be so liberal as to allow vodka and vermouth. That's it.
And shaken, not stirred. Right?
I like a little olive juice in mine, to be honest with you.
You like the dirty ones, yeah. I like a couple olives, and I prefer shaken. It does taste different to me.
Here's another a blogger entry from this guy named Russell Klein. He says he found too many cooks getting in over their heads with Asian fusion. Mm. Just because you put wasabi and soy on something doesn't make it Asian.
Well, you know, I think that there are certain aspects to every cultural food that make it approachable for a cook. I mean, there are certain things about some of those flavors that make everything taste good. You know, you can put some soy sauce and some wasabi on rice, and it can be delicious if mm-hmm. it's done right. I think when you don't have a lot of experience and you want to make a flash, sometimes you may lean on the easiest way to go. And that could be what that is to me.
Has anybody ever died from eating wasabi, just a glob of it, like happened to me almost almost lost my breath once.
Not that I've ever heard of, but I have occasionally felt like I was going to.
Here's another entry on the blog. Sliders of any variety, but particularly clever sliders because, you know what, a crab cake slider just isn't that clever.
Yeah, when did we start taking our culinary cues from White Castle?
Yeah. All right. Cupcakes. There's this this woman who's talking about she spent – well, let me read this. She said she started a cupcake bakery, ended up $100,000 in the hole, and then you realize all your friends were just being polite when they told you how delicious they were.
You know, I would think that would be related with mobility of food, be able to walk with something and eat it. Because we do more and more of that, especially in urban areas. You know, I mean, having something like that in your hand while you walk away, you know, I think is probably – and, the whole thing with the sliders as well. You know, it's like individual foods kind of.
Near as I can tell, the cupcake thing – and I sort of missed it. But the cupcake thing appears to have started right about the time the Atkins diet died. And the whole cupcake thing sort of jumped the shark before I was even aware of it. But I understand what this person's talking about with the bakery. I mean, it's often been said if a great way to make a small fortune is to start with a large one and open a restaurant.
What about, and just to change the subject for a minute, food vendors in open outside areas and city pedestrian malls? That seems to have just gone crazy, hasn't it, in some areas in the past 10 years or so? Aren't you seeing more and more of that?
I like street food when it's made well. We were in Los Angeles a couple of months ago. And went to the Korean barbecue truck, and oh my God, for $2 I got this Korean barbecue thing. It was just one of the best things I've ever eaten in my life. Had to wait in line a long time too.
It doesn't seem like that would also be related with the large influx of people from other countries.
I think it's a great answer to fast food.
Who have that? Yeah, exactly.
It's generally high quality. The food vendors. And people need something quick or want to get outside on their lunch hour and don't want to, you know, sit inside. It's relatively inexpensive. And, yeah, I think it's a great answer to fast food.
And they're generally small mom-and-pop operations. They're not you don't see very often anyway. You don't see a Burger King cart
right.
in the Ped Mall.
Ethnic food in Iowa, there's just a lot more of it today than the year 2000, right? And a lot of there's always some Chinese – places and even small towns, but now an incredible variety, really.
Yeah, the Mexican population, which I guess is related to the farming situation. Is that
farming
why?
And meatpacking.
Yeah, meatpacking, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's gotten really great. I don't know what else there is, though, that I noticed.
Here in Iowa City, we've got a Somali restaurant now.
Oh, yeah.
There's
a Korean restaurant in the mall in the Capitol Mall.
And you can find lots of things, especially in Des Moines. There's even more. The one that I would like to see that America hasn't quite gotten to yet is Persian food. And this is almost entirely because of the whole political problem between us and Iran. And be that as it may, this is some of the most magical food in the world. And I wish that we could see – if it weren't for all the politics, I'm convinced it would be at least as popular as Indian food is in this country, probably more so.
Wow. Why don't you go – try that next, Kurt.
I don't want to work that hard.
Have fun with that. Yeah.
Next on the list, pizzas that are anything but pizzas. The blogger writes, stuffed crust pizzas, fruit pizzas, dessert pizzas.
Oreo pizzas. Oh, God.
Cracker crust pizzas and pizzas with salmon on them and microwavable pizza rolls. Look, the pizza was a brilliant invention centuries ago. The first pizzeria in America was opened by Gennaro Lombardi in New York City in 1905. Everything after that has pretty much been all downhill. Agree, disagree.
I have an Italian brother-in-law who would agree.
Okay.
I've always thought that the Italians wouldn't have any problem with American pizza if we just didn't call it pizza. If we just called it something else, they'd think it was a delightful dish. But since we claim that it's pizza, they say, no, that's not pizza.
But there is a really nice growth in the good pizza.
Yes, there is.
Places, especially in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And the wood-fired ovens.
Yeah, wood-fired ovens, coal ovens. Yeah. There's a lot of that going on now. And I've had some of it, but really, really great.
Mm-hmm. Like what Simone Delaty makes at her farm and like what Dave Wiesnack is making at Motley Cow. Things like that.
Hardee's Monster Thick Burger, number 8 or something.
Why is it even on the radar?
I have nothing to say to that.
Have you ever had one?
No, I've never. I haven't been to Hardee's in 10 years.
At least. Mm-hmm.
Flourless chocolate anything. Looks like, I can't say the word, tastes like dirt, done everywhere. It's over.
Okay, well, they had a bad one because
they had a bad one,
good flourless chocolate.
It's built on this original recipe that is an underbaked cake. This is the lava cake, I'm assuming.
You're talking about totally flourless, not that liquid center.
Oh, okay.
But that would fall into the same category, though.
Yeah. I've had one that's very good.
Have you had it at Devotee? We have one there, and that's why I'm defending it so adamantly.
Right.
Dennis, when she asked that, you say yes. It was great.
I can't remember where it was from.
You don't need to. You just say yes.
We have a great one that our chef, no longer with us, but left it for us to serve, and it's a fantastic, fantastic flourless chocolate tart. So I have to disagree with that one.
Yeah, it's gourmet fudge is what it is. It's high end, well made, well presented fudge.
Next, the term foodie. I don't think you guys have ever used that, have you?
I think it's
horrible,
It's a usable word.
Yeah, you know, it's fine. I just haven't been able to think of a better one yet. That's all.
It's a way to say someone who's really interested in food, but uh-huh. You know, I mean, hopefully, we're all foodies.
And it usually, I think, refers, I think, in context to the non-professional cook,
mm-hmm.
Someone who is really into cooking. They really like food and they like dining and such. I don't know. I've don't see anything wrong with that term.
I like gastronome, but people think it sounds too snooty.
It does.
I also like gastronaut, but I don't think I can get that to catch on.
Yeah.
So.
Gastronaut's good.
It sounds like the high octane
stuff. I think so.
Number 10, raw food. Not raw food foods themselves, but the raw food movement. Blogger writes, leave it to the human race in this day and age to find something wrong with fire.
I absolutely agree with that. Applying heat to food is what separates us from the rest of the animal kingdom. It's vitally important.
It may be one thing that does separate us, but I like raw food sometimes.
From time to time, but there are folks who eat that stuff exclusively.
I know.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's not for me.
My understanding is it's not very good for your digestion.
I mean, a salad is raw food. It's good. I eat salads every day.
Okay, one more on the list. The $18 po' boys. Even the dimmest among us can understand irony when it's presented in such a bald form. And the dim, they tend to go for the torches and pitchforks when they realize they're being hoodwinked. I love po' boys.
$18?
Well, it's sort of like the $40 entree, which is...
We had one on our menu for a while, but it was only, what, 8.5, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, you don't see them very often in Iowa.
It's hard to know how to price things sometimes, because when they're eating at a place like ours, the things that we're purchasing are more expensive usually. Mm-hmm. You know, the organic, this, the free range, that.
And all of our overhead is higher.
And the overhead's higher, and you need to move that money back locally with the farmer that grew it. I think that's one of the issues with the chain places and fast food places is it makes a certain population that eats there think that they ought to be able to walk into my restaurant and get a $3 hamburger or something weird. I mean, it doesn't happen as much as it used to, but it used to happen sometimes. People would think that you know, like things were strangely expensive, but it's because it's actual food and it's worth it, you know. So,
just a minute or so left, about a minute briefly. Look ahead, assuming that the economy rebounds in the next decade, what do we have to look forward to? What are some trends you think, Matt?
Well, I think there's going to be more of this small plate sharing thing has been big for the past 10 years. I think it's a great way to get out there and not necessarily spend a lot of money and have an evening out. I love doing it myself. I think that there is more to be done with some of the science-y type stuff that's going on in some high-end restaurants. I think that's going to like filter down a little bit into more usage at other restaurants. And I think when it's used properly, I think it's a great thing. And I think the whole hog and the whole animal thing, cities passing rules that you're allowed to have chickens in cities, you know, raised in the backyard, that's happening more and more. I think not having the food separate from the people is definitely a trend that's going to keep going.
Kim?
Yep, I agree completely. that people are going to take more interest and are going to continue on that trend towards conscious consumption, knowing where things come from. I also agree in the sense of smaller, high quality portions and sharing rather than committing to a big steak, potatoes and green beans. Sharing lots of little things and not overeating. And it's a nice way to do it when you're sharing small portions. Then you're still hungry, you can always order more. I like that.
Kurt.
Yeah, I too got to echo the small plate thing, especially because we've run a tapas restaurant for 13 years. And also we've just introduced pinchos, which are even smaller, little $2 bites of different things that are also a lot of fun to share. Got to disagree with Matt on the whole molecular cuisine science stuff. I'm just not a fan. It's too. I guess I'm too old fashioned fuddy duddy for it or something.
Well, just because you're not into it doesn't mean it's not going to spread a little bit into other.
It may.
Venues.
And the other thing I'd see is a wider spread of some more interesting meats. People have pretty well accepted bison now, and I think they're going to start spreading out to some other ones that used to be relegated strictly to hunters, like venison, like game birds, elk, even emu, which we serve at the restaurant. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you all very much. Kurt, Kim, Matt, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Kurt and Kim Fries operate the restaurant Devotee, publish the magazine Edible Iowa River Valley. Matt Steigerwald runs the Lincoln Cafe in Mount Vernon. That's Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese for Greg Shanley.